I've been asked to give my testimony, and I shall do so within about, say, 20 minutes. If you have questions, you're welcome to put them. Now, I was born in Cheshire, just south of Manchester. As you heard from Mr. Murray, I come from English and Welsh connection. My father's side were Welsh, my parents were English-speaking, but my father's parents were Welsh-speaking. I was brought up by loving parents, but they weren't Christians, and we never had family worship, and we virtually never went to church. However, in the goodness of God, somehow I made it my practice as a young child to pray, usually every night. I believe I left off for some years as an early teenager, but went back to the practice. So I was never an atheist. Things began to be important for me in a spiritual sense when I went to university. The only thing I ever wanted to do was to be a teacher. So I went to university. Newcastle-on-Tyne was part of Durham University, and I took a degree in Latin and Greek. I wanted to teach those two languages. In the first term of the first year, who did I meet but a young Welsh boy from South Wales who was the son of an evangelical minister and who was himself a minister. I'm sorry, preparing, I should say, for the ministry, and who was himself a Christian. And this young man befriended me very kindly and invited me to go to the Christian Union meetings done by what was then called the IVF. UCCF is the modern name for it. Now, these were good, good meetings, and the gospel was being taught and preached in these meetings, and I had attended a Methodist church for a few years in, say, Old Cheshire, where I come from, but there was no gospel there at all. So the influence of this Welsh boy was very important in my life. And I remember about December of one year, I went to a meeting which was very impressive indeed about the gospel. And I took from the meeting a little free John's gospel, which they were giving out to visitors like me. And late in December, God began to deal with me in a way that I began to be conscious of. You know, it's hard to express this in adequate language, but I knew about the end of December, and the year was 1957, quite a while ago. I knew that God was beginning to do something in my life, and I testify against myself when I say I didn't welcome it, I didn't want it. And it became stronger and stronger and stronger. And so, after a foolish night out one day, on a Saturday night, I believe, I took out this John's Gospel, and I think from memory, I pretty well read it all through from start to finish. And it must have had an effect upon my mind. Well, we turn from December of 1957 to January and of the next year, and what happened next was, I began to come under real conviction of sin. I didn't know what it was, but I felt absolutely miserable. And I came to the point in which, in a lecture being given one day at university, I just could not concentrate on what was being said. So I more or less said to God, I'll do anything to get peace. And I don't know how it happened, but words of the Bible came to my mind. Now, I didn't know the Bible, but these words came to my memory from some source. And the words were these: all things work together for good to them that love God. And I said, well, if that's the case, then I must sort out my life. So I got rid of some friends that were no good to me, and I wrote one or two letters to say, goodbye, we're finished. And I stopped going to certain places that were not helpful. And I began to go to Christian Union meetings at the university. And by the end of January of that year, I believe I came to faith in Christ. not without tears. It was a very difficult experience. It really was like being pulled, you know, from one's previous style of life into a new world altogether. So at the end of January, I took the train and went home to Manchester, where my parents were living, where I was brought up. And I remember an interview with my dear father, not an easy one. I said to him, "Father, I've become a real Christian." "Oh," my father said, he was a very kind man. "Oh," said my father, "it'll pass off, you know, like everything else, just a phase." But I knew very well nothing would take that away from me. I knew it was forever. I don't know how I knew, but I did. So I said to him, "Father, would you mind if I read the Bible in the family to you and to mother and to my sister?" My sister Anne was 6 years younger than me. I was born just before the Second World War, and she was born toward the end of it. "No," said my father, "you read the Bible to us, that's fine." She was a very nice person. He wasn't a Christian, didn't pretend to be, didn't go to church. But he allowed me to read the Bible, and I did all I could to get my family to a good church. Mother came first, and after a few years she was converted. She was a devout sort of person. And then my sister, I never forget this one. She was at the stage of being a middle teenager, say 15, 16, and she was beginning to like the things that I had liked before my conversion. And it was a Saturday night, and she was going to go to the dance in Manchester. The dance, that was the big enjoyment, the dance. She was all done up for it, as girls can be. So I said, "Anne, the taxi's coming soon, isn't it?" "Yes," she said, "I'm waiting for the taxi to take me there." I said, "There's nothing in these things, you know. I've tried them and it's a dead loss." She didn't like that. So the taxi came and she jumped into the taxi and she went all the way to Manchester, 6 miles. And then, to my surprise, she came back quite early that night. And I could see on her face it hadn't been very exciting. So I saw my golden moment. "Sit here," Anna said, "beside the fire. I'll make you tea and toast." Now that's my formula for happiness, tea and toast. So the tea and the toast were being prepared and she sat there, obviously glum. I said, "Wasn't I right now? There's nothing in this silly nonsense, worldly dancing. Christ is the main thing. You've got to get him." She began to cry. Tears ran down her face. So I enjoyed the tea and toast that day very much, I can tell you. And she came to faith in Christ, and she married a very fine Christian man some years later. I'm jumping ahead a little here. And the two of them went to Turkey and were missionaries in Turkey for a number of years. There were about half a dozen Christians in Turkey at that time, because it's very much a Muslim society. But I'm told today there are some hundreds of Christians in Turkey, and you know, the gospel is making some progress. She has been blessed with 3 children, all grown up now, of course, and by the grace of God, they're all professing faith in Christ. And they're getting grandchildren, and they are now professing. And I heard just the other day that one of the grandchildren of my daughter wants to go in for the ministry of the Reformed faith. I was deeply thankful to God. What a privilege. Well, now back to myself. When my sister was converted, she and I were working now on our father. Now, my father was a clever man, but he never had opportunity to study when he was young. He had to leave school about the age of 14 to clean locomotive boilers. You know, these are the old steam engines that went puffing out steam as they went down the track. His duty was to clean inside them. Not a very edifying task, I wouldn't think. So he could have gone to university but didn't have the opportunity. So many of that generation of Highland people, as well as Welsh and English people, just never had the chance. They had no money. So when my father was, about the age of 50-something, he said to me, "Can I teach him French?" Because I knew quite a lot of French from learning at school. So I said, "Yes, I'll teach you French." So I taught him how to read the French language, and he quickly overtook me and read about 70 books in French, which I couldn't have done. But then, when I was converted and my sister was converted, we conspired. to buy him a French Bible. And my sister did something I didn't dare do. You see, girls can get away with things where their fathers or sons can't get away with. My sister once said to my father, she said, "Father, you used to be a reader. You used to read all manner of books. But now," she said, "that horrible black box," meaning the television. It was then black and white, of course. There was no colour television. "That horrible black box is in the house," she said. She said to my father, "Throw it out, Father, and start back on your books." I wouldn't have dared to say that to my father. But being a girl, she got away with it, and the black box was put at the roadside, and it was thrown out. That was the end of that. And he started to read again. So my sister and I bought my father's French Bible. And he read it, and read it, and read it, and read it, till the back fell off it. And then we got him into a good church, not so far away. But the crucial time was a little bit later. I'll come back to the intervening things, but jumping ahead a little bit now. When I was married, we managed to have our honeymoon in Inverness. And when we were there, my parents took a cottage, and we skillfully managed to get my father and mother to come to hear Mr. Donald MacDonald, Grey Friars. And my father had never heard preaching like that in his life. And then we got him down to Edinburgh, St. Columba's. Professor Collins was preaching then, and again, he'd never heard preaching like that. He was deeply impressed by these preachers in the Free Church of Scotland. And following up the story of my father, he was converted somewhat toward the end of his life. And he took a stroke, latterly, before he died. And he was in the hospital in Withenshaw, Manchester, a huge hospital. As you can imagine, Manchester is such a big place. And my wife and little girl, I'll come back to the intervening bits in a minute, my wife and little girl stood round the bed and spoke to Father. And I said to him, "Father, I'm going to ask you a question, not now as a son, but as a minister," because I was then a minister. I said, "Father, are you trusting in Jesus Christ as you leave this world?" Now, he couldn't speak with a stroke, but he could hear, and so he nodded. I said, "I'm going to repeat the question. Are you trusting in nothing but Christ as you leave this world?" Nodded. Then I said to him, in that case, Father, it won't be long before you and I are together in heaven." Tears ran down his face. That's the last I saw of him. I believe he died a godly man. Coming back now then, when I was a young Christian, I was a sweet Arminian, if you know there is such a thing, for about 3 years. And then a university friend of mine, who was a real Christian, said this. He said in conversation, he said, "For whom did Christ die?" Oh, I said, "Of course, for everybody." Then he said, "Well, why isn't everybody saved?" I'd never thought of that. Because if Christ dies for you, it means you're saved. So he explained to me that Christ's atonement is what we call a limited atonement. He died for his elect, or those whom God has given to him, those who come to him and believe. Of course, the gospel is for everybody. Everybody's welcome to come. But in the end of the day, it's for those who come that Jesus died, not for those who go to hell. And that set me thinking I'd better do some reading in theology. So, at university there was a book table, and believe it or not, there was Calvin's Institutes, 2 volumes. Dr. Lloyd-Jones had just encouraged their publication again. 2 volumes of Dr. Lloyd-Jones, 2 volumes of Calvin's Institutes. They were going for 30 shillings. Do you remember what that means? £1.5. And of course, I was very careful about my money. I didn't have too much money to throw about as a student. I thought, is it good stewardship to buy Calvin's Institutes? I smile at that now. But I bought them, and when I read them, the doctrine of God, so immense, I felt like the size of a spider on the end of a tiny string dangling under God's absolute sovereign control. I'd never had the feeling before. So Calvin's Institute had a profound effect upon my thinking. So I said I'd better get to know more about this Reformed faith. And the next step was Banner of Truth. Now, the Banner of Truth began its publishing work of excellent books and a magazine in the 1950s. And I met Ian Murray in London by accident once. I won't go into the details, but I met him, enjoyed meeting him in Westminster Chapel because I'd gone there to hear Dr. Lloyd-Jones. And went to one of Ian Murray's afternoon Bible studies in Westminster Chapel. Excellent. I can still remember what he taught to this very day. It was 1 Samuel 8, 9 and 10. I'd never heard anyone explaining the Bible in that sort of way. It was amazing. So profitable. So edifying. So then I began to get the Banner of Truth magazine and to read it. And that led, of course, to buying Banner of Truth books, which my excellent friend, Mr. John Murray, was busy helping to publish and to disseminate, though I had not yet met him. But now, having become something of a reformed Calvinist, I had a remarkable experience. I went down to London to hear Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, because in the north of England there was nothing very good in terms of church life. It was very average and very poor and very liberal. So on one occasion, when I was in my place of residence where I was staying for the weekend, I met a gentleman who was a total stranger. He was dressed in black, no clerical collar, but white shirt, black tie. And in conversation, I realized this man believes everything I believe. Because at this stage, I was now convinced of exclusive psalmody. And that came about by reading a magazine from America called The Blue Banner, Faith and Life. It's a Reformed Presbyterian publication, and I've been reading these magazines, and I was convinced that we should have no organ and sing the psalms. And in conversation with this man, I discovered that he had the same view, the same doctrine. I said, "What church are you? I've never come across a minister who believes all that." "Free Church of Scotland," he said. "I come from the ministry of a church in Ardersier." I didn't know where it was. I didn't know where Odyssey was at that time. Right beside Inverness, of course, where the airport is. So I said to myself, well, I must get to know more about this church. And he said to me, well, come and hear me preach. Because there was a free church, of course, there meeting in a YMCA, I think it was, or YWCA, perhaps, in London. And he was the preacher. I'll never forget it. Evening service. It was a Christmas time, as they call it, down in England. And it was a smaller room, smaller than this by far. And let's say this is the door where you enter in and go through. There's a central aisle and seats on that side, seats on that side. Maybe about 50 people or something in from memory. And at the farther end, where the pulpit was a Christmas crib, all lit up with beautiful shepherds and sheep. And I marvel at this. But then came the minister, with a black gown in his hand, walking in solemn, stately fashion. And he dropped the black gown on the whole of the crib, so it vanished out of sight. I said, "That's my church." So, I then concluded I wanted to be a member of the Free Church of Scotland. I had a lovely Bible class of young children in the school when I taught at that time. I was now a teacher. And I said to the children in the church, in the school, "I really am a member of the Free Church of Scotland, but I'm so far away I can't worship with them." So what happened next was this. I said, "What I'll do, I'll go to Edinburgh, because in Edinburgh, that must be the headquarters of the Free Church, because that's the capital of Scotland, and I suppose that's where all the big things happen for the Free Church of Scotland." So in the summertime, I went by train to Edinburgh. And stayed overnight, very close to where Mr. Grace's church is, I think. Where his man's rather either is or was. And here's the strange thing. Next day, I walked into the centre of Edinburgh, looking for information about the Free Church of Scotland. I found a policeman. I said, "Where are the offices of the Free Church of Scotland?" This was a Saturday. "Oh," he said, "there's a policeman down the road. He's an office bearer with them. He'll tell you. I don't know." So I walked along to this man who was directing traffic. He said, "It's up and round and top of the mound." So I quickly went away with no questions asked or answered. But it was a Saturday and the shop was closed and I couldn't get in. So I wandered round Edinburgh buying a few old books, you know, one does that as a hobby. And at 5 o'clock or so, I was walking down past St. Giles Cathedral, and here was the policeman just finishing his duties. And as only a policeman can do, he said, "Are you the man?" I said, "I am." And in 5 minutes of conversation, we were the firmest of friends. I discovered he came from a strange place called Lewes. I never heard of such a place before. But when I went to his home the next day and had his kind hospitality, I was amazed at his knowledge of this book and his knowledge of the Reformed faith and the catechism. Now, I'd studied hard to improve my Bible knowledge for the last few years, but I didn't know my Bible anything like as well as he did. Oh, yes, he spoke about a minister called Mr. Kenneth McRae of Stornoway. He talked about a congregation of over 1,000 and said that Mr. McRae wouldn't go to see Her Majesty the Queen on a Saturday because, he said, I'm preparing sermons for the Lord of Hosts. I can't spend time seeing earthly people. I thought, what sort of man is this? What sort of people are these? So, was it, I think, 2 summers after that, I decided I must go to Lewes. I wanted to see where Mr. McRae had preached, because he died in 1964, I believe, about May of 1964, so I went in, I think, July of 1964. I just wanted to see the building for once in a lifetime where he had preached. It never crossed my little mind that I would one day preach there a few times. And I had a lodging prepared for me, Garden Road, I think it's called, in Stornoway. And I was invited by a friend who knew my contact in Edinburgh. Indeed, it was a sister of the contact of a policeman in Edinburgh. And she said, "Come next day and we'll have a cup of coffee in the afternoon." So I went along to her flat in Bayhead Street. And this lady was there. And there was another young lady there. And thereby hangs a tale. She turned out to be Mr. William McLeod's sister, Sandra. And what can I say? She was the best woman in all the world for me, anyway. And I've never repented of that. A wonderful wife. I'm highly honored by God. But I had a wonderful experience of meeting Mr. William McLeod's father and mother. Wonderful people, wonderful people. And himself, he was just a boy at the time, and his sisters were teenagers. That was an extreme privilege for me, 1964. Now, I was married in 1965, and I was a teacher then for some years after that, until one day I felt God was pulling me towards the ministry. And perhaps I should stop at this point shortly. So what I did was this. I decided to go with my wife to Glasgow, to the minister of Partick Highland Free Church, whom I knew very well. Mr. Donald MacLeod, as his name was, minister of Partick Highland. And I said to him, "Donald," I said, "I can't get any peace of mind. I feel called to the ministry. What should I do?" And he said to me, "Well, remember Abraham, who went out not knowing where he would go?" And I knew what that meant. It meant go to the Free Church College and prepare for the work of the ministry, which I did. And started to preach in Ayr after my course of training in 1974. And I was there for nearly 20 years. We had a time of great happiness there. At first it was very small and very difficult, but God was very good to us and we had certain encouragements there. And then, after 19 or 20 years there, I was called to Greyfriars in Inverness, and I was there until the sad division, which gives us no pleasure to talk about 12 years ago, 13 years ago in my case. But I love the Free Church of Scotland and all that it has stood for in its best character. And I wish nothing but good to those who are in the continuing and those who are on the other side. I wish nothing but good to them all. And I pray, God, that a day will come when the Spirit of the Lord will give revival to us all and see Christ's cause flourishing again.